75 or 80 degrees at 11,500 feet, which is real unusual. Anyway, I noticed the ETT started to climb, and then right after that, the engine quit. So I couldn't restart. I looked down, and on one mountaintop there, I saw a one-lane road. So I put it right on there. I looked going down that hill. It looked like if I ever touched one of those wingtips on a tree, I was going to roll this thing up in a ball roll all the way down that mountain. So I pointed it up the hill and went 35 inches manifold pressure, and the darn thing just went right on out of there. That's all that mattered. So I climbed up to 13.5, turned on the radios, and the first thing I heard was I had 122.6 I had left on from talking to flight services. And first thing I heard, experimental 4 kilo Romeo, can you answer on this frequency? First time anybody ever called me, and boy, that waked me up. I guess I was an hour overdue on my next checkpoint. And so it was Farmington Flight Service. So I told them I'm okay, and I'll just be an hour delayed, that's all. I didn't tell them what happened to me, but... and actually, it didn't even bother me until that night in the motel. And then every time that air conditioner went off, I just flew right out of that bed. The engine quit. So anyway, I flew all the rest of the way here, uneventful, but I'm still shook. I haven't even done any flybys since then. Just thinking about it. But that's another one of those things. What other problems we have? That's not really a problem, but it shows you what you can do. I'm flying the KR-2 right now with a gas glider bypassed, because it's got to be moved to the other side of the airplane before I fly it with it hooked up again. Is there any areas someone would like me to cover in any of this in particular? Yes. Yeah, did we change the airfoil on the KR-3? We certainly did. We went to the 4412. That's what's on there now, and that part is already redone. The GAW-1 airfoil is great, you know, nice low stall speed and all that, but we sure didn't like the stall characteristics. I noticed it in flight before the accident happened that anytime you did stall it would do a snap roll. And it didn't always go the same way. It depended on which wing was lower. If it was just one wing was slightly lower, that's the way it rolled. It came out almost inverted most of the time. And a couple of times going into the lake, we would stall it at about 3 feet off the water, and it would do a 90-degree turn, you know, start the roll, and just go in sideways. And after all the water settled down, and with the canopy closed and all, you didn't get too wet. Everything was all right. We never damaged the airplane doing that. But one day going into Corona, one other pilot chopped power at 10 feet, and the thing went up, did a full stall, rolled completely over, and went in. He come crawling out all that styrofoam. So, anyway, the FAA said that could have been a real bad situation if it was any other type of construction. But the foam and light wood and everything like that, the pilot wasn't hurt. What was the stall speed? Well, we never stalled it at gross weight. With one person in and maybe 20 gallons of gas in it, it was stalling in around the 40-mile-an-hour range, right at 40. So I figured at gross weight, it'd be in the 45, 46 range. The status, it's parked on the gear, and a lot of hardware is going back on. None of the metal fittings or anything like that were damaged in this accident. And the engine, of course, is in right here right now. I ordered a new engine for that one because we needed this one right now, and I wanted to put in the KR-1. The engine that used to be in my KR-1 is now in the motor glider. The KR-1 that we built originally at the same time as this one that we converted to a long wing version. And I haven't had, it's all built licensed, N28 KR, but I haven't had a chance to take it out and fly it. It's still parked in my hangar. Chances are I might get a chance as soon as I get back from Oshkosh. Okay, he wants to know my feelings on substituting glass for Dynel. Well, probably in another year we're going to have to, because that's about the time we'll be running out of Dynel. Using 8-ounce fiberglass in place of the 5-ounce Dynel will give us the same thickness that we need for the compressive strength we need in the airplane. So it works fine. One of the reasons I went to the Dynel over the fiberglass was it was saved a little bit of weight, and it was a lot easier for me to sand. I didn't itch after. I noticed the difference right away when I had to open up some of the inlets on this KR-1 out in the field one day. I had to do some power sanding on it, and the cowl was made of fiberglass because it's pre-molded. All the pre-molded parts on the airplane are made of fiberglass. And boy, I'm still itching from that. So that's my opinion. It's fine. Uh, About covering the underside of the surface. Right. These are sandwiched because that's the fuel tank. Especially this KR-1 where the entire wing is a fuel tank. It's all glassed on the inside, one layer, one thin layer. Okay, the foam goes on 1 inch thick, and you have a little bit above that, so you carve it down to the airfoil, and then on the inside, you start carving away. So I would say roughly half an inch thick. Maybe a little bit more, up to 5/8. Half inch to 5/8 thick is what it's been coming out for the skin thickness on the tanks, that's the top and bottom surfaces. Yes. Sure. Making the KR-1 a tandem, well, the problem was getting the weight and balance in. It was so critical, and we sure didn't want to make an airplane where you had to fly it from the rear seat. That's an easier way out, but I don't care for that kind of flying. I like flying a lot of fun to me, and if I had to sit in the back seat and have the instruments way up in front, it just doesn't appeal to me. And if you got a passenger in between you, then you can't see the instrument panel, and I didn't want to put in two instrument panels. There's also, I considered building a full IFR airplane, and it's pretty hard to do that on a single place or tandem airplane. If you look at the panel on my KR-2, you'll see that I got it pretty well loaded, and I still don't have a lot of things I want in there. But I'm gradually getting it all in there. I pretty well loaded this KR-1 to just show you what you can do on a single place airplane. He asked if I changed the airfoil on the any KR-1 or KR-2. No, I did not, ever. There were some slight errors in placement of the spar in the airfoil. I think it was off a quarter of an inch or so in some places. But we made up some later drawings to try to correct that, and it turned out the later one wasn't much better. It was off the other way or something like that, I forgot. But no, we did not change the airfoil. We're still using the original ones. And both of these airplanes were built from those original plans, not the later plans anyway. And quite a few of them are flying satisfactorily from the original. Yes. Well, even the last 4 years, the airfoil is okay. One thing about this particular airfoil is it really isn't that critical. It's not a real critical airfoil. It's not like a laminar flow or anything like that. Have I ever thought about a twin? No, it's actually a 4. Oh, I see. Not out of the KR-3, no. Out of the KR-2. We actually have worked on it quite a bit to come up with a little half-size Cessna 310 or something like that. And yes, KR-4 will not be a T-tail, I'll tell you that now. We actually have made up tooling to pre-mold most of the fuselage on it, but I have not built one. I've just made parts for test purposes. Yeah, it looks like it'll be about a 3-seater and twin engine, tricycle gear. And right now I'm trying to work out a way of making a pressure bulkhead inside so that we can actually play with a little bit of pressurization, about 2 PSI. Okay. Give you about 4,000-foot altitude increase inside. Because my favorite altitude is 16.5, by the way. And if I could get 2 PSI in there, I could get rid of that oxygen tank. I've made several flights where I stopped for gas at the next airport and put in $15 worth of gas, and they charged me $14 to refill my oxygen tank. And that made me think about that. Mm-hmm. The 65 Franklin's the two-cylinder one, isn't it? Yes. He wants to put a 65 Franklin in a KR-2. I'd rather put a Continental 65 in, personally, because I have seen KR-2s with them in. Well, putting in a 65 horse instead of a, say, this KR-1 is 90 horsepower, by the way. I don't think it makes any difference. The airplane is stressed for it. Matter of fact, the KR-2s have flown with 85 Continentals. So I don't think there's a problem. I've heard good reports on it. I can't tell you it's the greatest because I didn't build one, so I don't know. I know the airplane will take it. I've seen a KR-2 with a 65 in it, and it looks sort of funny to me to see that big nose. And looking at it head on, it looks like an air coupe. But I don't think they look as good. And I know it won't go as fast. Because it actually accrues power. You have less power than I have right now. Yes. He asked about the Volkswagen longevity with a turbocharger. Well, when you really come down to it, a Revmaster conversion is not a Volkswagen engine. It's got bigger bearings, a heavier crankshaft, it's counterbalanced, it's a longer crankshaft, everything like that. I don't really have experience with a stock VW with a turbo supercharger. But actually, it shouldn't be that much harder on the light because you only use overboost, we'll say, for several seconds for takeoff. And what it does do is it makes all airports sea level. So it's just like you were always flying out of a sea level airport, where without it, it's whatever the density altitude is. So you'll have, if you always take off by a certain manifold pressure, we'll say you use a stock 1600, you could go 35 inches for takeoff without hurting anything. I don't think that would hurt anything. If you hold it there, your temperatures are going to be increasing all the time. Yes, but this has nothing to do with the engine. He's asked about, I don't have a wastegate, so the turbo's running all the time. It actually is idling even all the time, but it's not boosting. The boost depends on your manifold pressure. So it's actually spinning in a vacuum. There's no pressure or anything like that when the carburetor's closed. It actually doesn't turn very fast either then. It's just idling. Matter of fact, it'll even roll to a stop. That's the turbine will. But when you are pushing above atmospheric pressure, that's when it runs up. Above what it would normally pull if you were opened up wide open with no turbo. Then it runs up. So there's really, it shouldn't affect the life of the engine that much. What fuel do I use? I use only Aviation 100. Only. I have found, even though on these turboed ones, the compression ratio is only 7 to 1, if you go above 25 inches manifold pressure with 80 octane, you can definitely hear the ping. And you can feel that power fall off. Also, the temperature skyrocket. I only tried it one time. 100 octane, I have no problem. I even worry about 100 low lead sometimes. Because I want good 100 octane. I've been told that it'll run all right with automobile height tests, but that's awful hard to find at airports. So I haven't got that much experience with it. Sure. The original KR1 did have folding wings, yes. We had it fixed so that the wing attach fittings exactly lined up, so that all we had to do was pull the bottom fittings and then fold the wing up, and then we had a bracket that would bolt onto the bottom fittings and it'd lock it in the up position. But we found out trailering it that way, anything went by fast the other way, it just about blew the whole thing over, and we were afraid of breaking fittings and so on like that. So we just started taking the wings off and sliding them underneath, and we just eliminated the attached fittings. It only takes about 15 minutes to take the wings off anyway. It's better to make brackets to hold the wings separate from the airplane. So we really don't have that much use for folding wings. If you need to put too many of them in one hangar, we found out you only have to pull one wing and then set them in caddy corner, and that's no big deal. It's just pull the bolts and slide it back. That's it. Oh, you want to know where the halfway point is on building your airplane? Well, right. I figured the halfway point is when you've got the engine installed, you're running it, and everything's on there, and you're ready to start sanding and finishing to paint it. That's the halfway mark. So I take it you're not that far yet. Because I've had a lot of people tell me they're halfway, and I found out they just got finished with a side frame fuselage, and they were ready to bolt their gear on. Because a lot of people can get that far in 2 weeks real easy. And actually, as far as having it on the gear, I've talked to several people who've done that one night, bolted all the parts together and put it on the airplane that one night, and then I've talked to other people who played with it for weeks before they got everything lined up. So that's pretty well up to the builder. Sure. Well, I'm not a top-notch painter. I've got one of the guys in my shop that knows quite a bit about it. He's been using plain old lacquer primer and automotive lacquer on there. And, I see. Well, as long as we got a coat of white on the outside, we haven't had any problems with it. That's why all my airplanes are white, and then I put a color on top of that.
Well, it's a dark gray primer, yes. But that's what we've been using. It's not a silver or anything like that. We've been just using the dark gray. Have I found a spot to locate the static air source? I'll tell you what I have done. I was playing around with it for a while, and then I found the best places where your elevator spar comes through. You have a slot there to make enough room so you have enough up and down travel. So since that's the best place, I've been just using the whole inside of the airplane, because that is dented right there. But I have found that there are some errors that crept in because of this. For example, at really low speeds, where right at a stall, the airspeed actually on mine will read a little lower than it than the calibration. And when I get above 170, 180 indicated, it starts reading high, which I think is great. Especially when you're demonstrating. So when I get up about 200 indicated, I'm good. Or above, I'm over 10, I'm 10 high now. So, and so it'll read 210 then, and I think that's fine too, especially when you're demonstrating. So, yeah, but I have found in the 100 to 150 range, indicated range, where you are at normal cruise at any altitude, I'm pretty well on the money. And so for long trips, it's fine with me. See, the only times I want to meet the top end is when I'm doing flybys or demonstrating it, and I know about it. So we won't talk that much more about it. Okay, he wants to know about the hours on the Revmaster with the turbo. Okay, for one thing, the Revmaster turboed engines are not the same as the non-turboed ones. The non-turboed ones are 9.5 to 1 compression ratio, for one thing. Turboed ones are 7 to 1. And actually the life should be about the same. I'm trying to think. They really don't know what the TBO is. Revmaster's only saying 1,000 hours right now, and they have gotten one back now with 1,450 hours. And they did tear it down and found out that everything was still in spec, so they put it back together without overhauling it. So anyway, that's the highest time one known. This is without anything going wrong with it or anything like that, because I know they've gotten some lower time ones and some things have gone wrong. Like for instance, one in San Diego, I know recently they got back, but we pulled the valve cover to check his valves and put it back on, the gasket fell down inside. And then he took off, and he threw all the oil out, and I guess the engine seized right after that. And they got it back all right, and they brought the engine back, and they went over the engine then. They didn't find that much wrong with it. One bearing is seized in it. That was about it. See, things like that can happen. Yes? Okay, he wants to know the comments between our three-blade ground adjustable and the Maloof constant speed. Well, the three-blade ground adjustable actually is as good at any particular point. If you're set for climb, it'll climb as good. If you're set for cruise, say, normal cruise, say, at 2,000 feet, it'll work as good as the constant speed. And if you set it up for a high altitude, it'll work as good at that point. But any other point, it won't be as good. But you have to remember that that particular prop is lower cost, like $240 versus $700, $800. And if you do happen to clobber it or land gear up, it's going to cost you some $40 blades. The wood blades shatter really easy. You don't hurt the crankshaft or engine or anything like that. Where if you clobber one of these Maloof props, that metal blade, chances are it's going to cost you a couple of hundred bucks for the blades, plus most likely a $245 crankshaft. So it all depends on the pilot, what he wants. If it's economy. It's it's how much you can afford. If the sky's the limit, I don't think you can beat this Maloof constant speed prop. Yes, we've tried injection molding blades for these, and we've tried a few different materials, different percentages of fiberglass, and we've tried Kevlar and carbon filaments. And we had a test stand set up, put out 140 horsepower, and we'd run them up and see where they failed. And sure enough, we made every one of them fail. One of them sounded like it was starting to work, so I stuck one in my airplane. And on our first flight, I was heading for the Port of the Fly-In. I think I got right in the middle of the Los Angeles TCA, right over there, LA International, and one blade disappeared at 4,000 feet. So I did a quick shutdown after I could catch that mag switch, that is, because the instrument panel's going around so fast, I couldn't catch it. I think that's the reason why the engine stayed on. And the airplane is so light that when the engine moved around real fast, the airplane went with it. So on a factory airplane, I know somebody on a Mooney lost a prop blade, and the engine just turned right around inside the cowl before he got it shut down. Complete 180-degree turn. But on this, the whole airplane goes around, so it doesn't matter. But anyway, I looked down on that, and I wasn't going to land in L.A. International and all that. So Nick's airport is Hughes Airport. If you land there, they call the cops. So I continued on, and Nick's airport was Santa Monica, and I was down to 3,000 feet by the time I got there. So I circled down and landed. The shakeup, I caused a fitting come loose under my instrument panel, so I had a gas leak on my lap. It was dripping on my lap, so I didn't turn on any radios or anything. I left everything off and came in. That's a controlled airport. So I made the first turn off, went into a Yankee dealer, and I had the big truck coming after me with yellow flashing lights and all that sort of thing. He says, "Why don't you call a tow when you land here?" And I says, "Well, I had a few leaks and didn't want to turn on my radio." And he looked at my missing propeller blade and got back in his truck and left. I didn't quite. Speaking of gas leaking, you want to know what about the wing tanks in the KR2? My KR2 has wing tanks. Oh no, I've never found any trace of that blade yet. It might have made it all the way to the ocean. See, that's only a few miles from the beach, and I think that's what happened, because I never did hear a report on that. As soon as I landed, I called the shop, and they were there in about a half an hour with my pickup truck, and by the time they got there, I had the wings off and everything like that, so we just loaded up and drove away. I never heard any more about it. So, anyway, repaired the damage. I didn't make that to the Porterville flying. I just didn't feel like flying the rest of the weekend. Okay, this next question is, what about synthetic oils? I tried it for a while, and I didn't know it was getting improvement in performance, and it cost too much, and I still want to change it. Without an oil filter, I still want to change it every 30 hours or so. So it's I don't have it right now. Yes. Oh, you mentioned the flaps. That's it. I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was on my thing to talk about, and I forgot all about it. I put flaps in my KR2 last time I had it in the shop. One of the reasons why I even considered it was because for this air race I'm in tomorrow, I need a commercial pilot's license. And to get it, it says you have to have 10 hours of high-performance time. And I looked it up what the high-performance time call is. And it says over 200 horsepower or constant speed prop or controllable pitch prop, retractable gear, and flaps. I looked at my airplane and I didn't have any flaps. And then I went over and priced a high-performance airplane. Sure. They started at $45 plus 11 for an instructor, because I wasn't checked out in one. And you can't fly without the instructor unless you got $25 for insurance reasons. So we're talking like $55 or more an hour for 10 hours. So anyway, I had the airplane in the shop, so I got out a hacksaw blade and started sawing. And I figured, well, if I'm going to put them on, I'm going to make them do something. So I carved it to open up the slot as they slid back and so on like that. And it was a fairly simple thing. I used all the parts out of the kit that was available in the kits, because that's all I had in the shop. So I'll tell you, if anybody wants a sketch, I didn't come up with the drawings yet. I'm going to work on them when I get a chance. But if anybody wants a copy of the sketches that, you know, I gave the guys in the shop to make up the parts so I could put them on, just send a self-addressed envelope and a dollar to the shop. And the girl will run off a Xerox copy of all my notes, stick them in your envelope, and you'll get it. And that's a nice, fast way if you have to have them right now, if you want them. But as far as flying with flaps on, well, I flew it for 4 years without any, and didn't know I needed them until I tried it. You know, and I fly out of a 1,600-foot strip with power lines across both ends. Of course, the power lines, that approach-end power lines always did worry me. I watched them so closely on final that a couple of times after clearing it, I looked up, and the runway wasn't in front of me. It was way over to the left or the right. Because I hadn't been paying attention to that, but now that I got flaps, I'm so much more nose down that I don't even have to give that a second thought. At the same airspeeds, see, I still use 70 on final end of that airport. 60 works fine when I'm alone. Even though this is quite a bit above stall, I still like the extra nice solid feeling of that extra airspeed. Do I consider up travel on the flaps? I believe this is only good on a GAW airfoil. I don't believe it would do a thing on this particular airfoil. For one thing, it might open up a slot underneath that I'd have to be designed out. But when my flaps close, everything closes up tight. There is no gaps underneath, like on a Cherokee. It's actually, the way the travel works on this is an exact copy of a Cherokee 140. If I accept that for that big slot underneath when it's closed. Cessna 150s, or all the Cessnas actually still got that slot underneath. I think that's a big drag penalty. When my flaps go up, it closes up completely. Even all the linkages are concealed when this happens. And I think that works much better. I see no advantages to having up travel on flaps. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I've never changed it since I put the flaps on. He asked about why the high approach speeds. Actually, that's not high. I use that on set when I'm flying a Cessna 150 also. I use the same approach speeds I use with a Cessna 150 or a Cherokee 140. Actually, a Cherokee 140, I use 80 on final. When I need a run a four-place airplane, I usually run a Cherokee, and I always use 80 on final on that, which is 10 more than I use for my Cessna, my Corvette 2. Yes? The assembly, that part of the assembly on the KR-1 is absolutely identical to KR-2, so I imagine it'd be the same thing. And next time my airplane is in the shop, I'm going to put them on. I just haven't had a chance yet. If I had I wanted to put them on right now, except that I wouldn't be able to bring the airplane to Oshkosh. I wouldn't be able to get the hours flown off it or anything like that. And I wanted to fly it here. I don't know if I will or not now, but I did want to be able to fly it. And that meant get the hours off, all that. And if I brought it in the shop, it'd be a whole week at least, and there's just no way I could have made it. But now when I get it back, I'll have more time to fool with it. And yes, I plan on putting flaps on. It's real simple. It doesn't add a whole pound to the airplane. And it sure makes a difference on that KR-2. The KR-1's got such a much higher sink rate anyway on its low speeds that it comes in a lot better. It's actually easier to land, and there isn't nowhere near as much float or anything like that. The KR-2 has a higher aspect ratio, so that's probably the reason for the extra float. Did you ever try spoilers? No, I did not. And I won't, because, I just don't see it, that's all. I've got other reasons, but that's okay. Go ahead.
All of
us have
your scope-like figure. Would you comment on making the fuselage of a KR-1 a little wider?
Would I comment on making the KR-1 fuselage a little wider? I've talked to quite a few people about an inch or two on their KR-1s, and I think it's great. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. That's one of the beauties of this build-your-own airplane, is that you sort of customize it to fit you. I have a KR-1 in my shop that'll fit a 6-foot-4-inch person with no trouble at all. The motor glider, to be exact. But this particular KR-1 is my custom one. I don't let anybody else fly it anyway, so I just moved everything up to fit me perfect. I just slide right in, it's just comfortable, and I can sit there all day. But anybody bigger than me is hard-pressed to get in and out and be comfortable. Matter of fact, his head will probably stick out the roof because I got my seat raised up and enough cushions under me and all that. But my comments is on and build it to fit you. There's not much in the penalty. You get a speed penalty on raising the canopy a little bit. Not much from widening it, by the way. Raising the canopy will give you a little speed penalty, yes. Mm-hmm. He widened his and he put a KR-2 motor mount. If you don't widen it, we build a KR-1 motor mount that will still fit. But yes, that's a good idea. Matter of fact, we've told a lot of people to do this before we got this one, the KR-1 welded engine mount. Available. We make one up now that'll fit a Redmaster Turtle 2100. Actually, we had to build one for this airplane, and so we just made up the tooling to run off as many as we wanted. And the surprising thing is, there's a lot of people ordering them, so I think there's going to be some real hot KR-1s around pretty soon. Yes? Do you use any special kind of glass on the inside of the wings? Well, see, the object of this is to seal it good. See, so we actually even put it on the spars so you don't get any gasoline into the wood. So, but any thin layer of anything actually is good as long as it's epoxy. So I think we used about 4 or 5 ounce fiberglass on ours to keep you, because you're not looking for a thickness or anything like that. You're just looking for a sealing. And you can't go, you put just paint on epoxy, because then it would you'd have chips and cracks and you wouldn't be able to detect them. So that means you needed some kind of a cloth in there, or something to fill up. So my opinion is use anything. Yes, and did we steal the spars with epoxy glass? Yes, inside the gas tanks we did, because the spars are the gas tank bulkheads. We don't want any fuel soaking into it. Right. But the front surfaces, you know, the leading edge, no, we did not. Right. And on this particular KR-1, the entire area between the spars is a gas tank. on the carrier one, it holds 20 gallons on each side. I have 10 forward, that's 50 total. At full cruise, about 240, 250 miles an hour, it gives me over 3,000 miles range. But there's another thing about this carrier one I noticed flying it. We had a photo session a week ago Saturday flying along a Cherokee 140. We're running that flat-out firewall. We're at the altitude we're only getting 105 indicated. And I noticed on my KL-1 pulling up alongside it, to stay with them, I had to go between 9 and 10 inches manifold pressure to still maintain. I had to run 2,600 on the prop, because below that, we're afraid we might fatigue the prop. So anyway, it turned out, between 9 and 10 inches, it turned out 1 gallon an hour. And I was indicating 105. So that means that if I use full power, we'll say, to climb the altitude, which would burn about 2 gallons of gas, then you level off, throttle it back to this 1 gallon an hour part, you'll probably average out 105, 110, and then you've got 48 hours to go. That's 2 days. I was thinking, hey, that's from here to Rome. So anyway, I see Doug Garner down there, and that's the reason why my fluidic autopilot is going in the KR1 and not the KR2. That's when I can get all the drift out of it. I've been playing with it for months, and I haven't been able to get it where it's stable enough to where it's sit there for half an hour at a time without slowly moving all the way to one of the stops. So if I can get after him to maybe help me a little bit more or something, I'll have an autopilot in that KR1. And actually, a trip like that, you really have to have it. Of course, I'll need a much longer oxygen supply, because if I make a trip like that, I'm going to go to real high altitude, like 25,000 feet. And see what it'll do. Sure, it's a question over here.
Are you going to see if we can get the airboys together and do a flyby today?
I will not be able to make a flyby today, because we got too much work to do. I still got to fix some things on the airplane from the trip. Like, for instance, my fuel pump went out, and I got to replace that today. And we got some dings and bangs we've got to work on. And I have to have it in Fond du Lac right after the air show, so it'll take us that long to get it ready to go. So I doubt if I'd be able to fly it. Unless it's after the air show. I might be able to do a few passes first and then run down there. That'll be about it. It'll be about 6:30 or so this afternoon. Matter of fact, two of us are going down in KR2s, because he's got to give me a ride back. I have to leave my airplane there for the night, because I'm in that air race tomorrow. Good. What is this air race? Nick Jones is the one in charge of it, and there's prize money involved. That's why I have my commercial pilot's license. No, it's pylon race, yes. It's 500 miles. If you burn over 18 gallons, you're disqualified. Yeah. See, so that I'm not even going to use my KR1 for it. I'm going to use the KR2. Very easy, and Steve Whitman's he's flying. Hey, that's something. I'm going to fly in an air race with Steve Whitman. Because I remember reading about him flying in races when I was in grade school, and I never thought I'd see the day I'd be in there with him. So, anyway, I'm going to fly the KR2 tomorrow in that. So I won't be able to do any flyby patterns today, but maybe starting tomorrow, after I get back tomorrow, that'll be running till about 11 o'clock. And I'll be back tomorrow afternoon, and we'll see after that. And I'll be here all week anyway. Yesterday, I heard Dan Dale was flying up there with a very easy, and there was a cassette also, the three of them were together. But why don't we get him up and ask him about that, what he was doing? Where is he? Is he here? Oh, there he is. Hey, Dan, why don't you come up here and tell us what you were doing? Because they were running me around in a Cessna 210 yesterday, showing me the race course, and I missed all that. I saw him up there flying, and I saw a very easy, and that was it, and then we left. All right, seems like... recognize a few of you all from last year. How many of you were here from last year? Yeah, quite a few. I was kind of curious, how many people have actually got down to buying the plans or have started cutting wood on your airplanes? Oh, wow. Fantastic. There's quite a few of these flying now. I've, from people who have corresponded with me from over the years, last couple of years in particular, all over the country. There's quite a few of them I've talked to, and they've got them going. So they're, although we don't have a whole bunch of them out here, I think people are leaving them at home and driving in or something. I don't know. It's kind of seems strange there isn't more of them here, but there's probably, what do you think, Ken? 400 or 500 of them flying?
Yeah, somewhere here.
Yeah, quite a few of them.
How many, does anybody have any questions that you want to ask somebody that's not selling plans? Yeah. Well, I can tell you what I've I have looped mine, rolled it both ways, lots of times. I went to a fly-in, in fact. It's to Tahlequah from Tulsa. It's like 60 miles. And I rolled it 30 times going over, 15 each way. That's just a good time. The I have done all kinds of stalls in it, hammerhead stall. I've never done any snap maneuvers at all. I have spun it both ways three turns, although I haven't spun it with somebody with me. That's, you know, when you're doing stuff like that, you go by yourself. But I stalled it both power on and power off with somebody in there. I have flown mine, by the way, if you want it. You're talking about size there a minute ago. I've had a guy in there 200 and he says 15 pounds, but he's three times as big as me. So I would guess more like 240 the way he lifts, but he's 6'3", and with some baggage, and we took off and went camping down in southeast Oklahoma. So we've gone cross country with a guy that much bigger than me, and with no problem at all. I've got a 2200cc. I built it up myself. It's basically built just like the Revmaster. As far as I use their drawings and stuff to make the bearings and the stuff inside. It's got a real mild camshaft, low compression, real mild on the valves and heads. No, mine is normally aspirated. I've got a the Posa 32 millimeter on it. I've got a friend that lives over in way over there in Indiana, and from Oklahoma, that's about 510 miles or so. And so I've been going over there to see her about 1 week a month. And I cruise in it. With mine, I cruise at anywhere between 12.5 and 14.5 with the normally aspirated. And I can indicate 130 all day long at that. So it trues out about 170 considering the temperature and stuff. I think maybe a little bit faster. I made the trip one day. I flew it nonstop and just was right at 3 hours. And I came back. That was the last month. And I came back at 14.5. A bunch of bad weather and stuff. I just went over the top. I used Aerolite. Aerolite, yeah. Yeah, real fine. One trick on that Aerolite that was pointed out, I'm working on another project, and I did some tests on it, and I found that if you put the glue, your mixtures on both sides of the woods before you put it together, you get a whole lot stronger bond. So, in other words, don't just smear it on one and put them together. Make sure you cover both surfaces and let it ooze and gooze all over. Then you know you got good contact. Let's see, that was the Aerolite. Okay, I'm thinking about Weldwood, so you're right. Okay, the question was, what type of glue did I use? And on the KR1, I used Aerolite. I mean, too. The new project I'm using, I did use some Weldwood. That's what I was thinking about. Sorry. Aerolite's good glue. Yeah. Now, the question was, how about aileron travel? At slow speed, no. You got plenty of aileron. It's with the full span like that, you got an awful lot of area, and just a little bit does a whole lot. You don't need much. That's a real good trick. I've flown mine now for 3 years. And the brakes, I let them squeak and grab until last weekend I finally decided to solve the problem. You're wondering, when you bolt them up, they're not true on the drum. You do no, not the wheel. What I did to solve the problem, I never really had very good brakes. Could run about 2200 on my run-up and then start pulling and going. I just took the axle and everything. Of course, it's got the quarter-inch hole drilled through it. Put it between centers and a lathe. You might have to go to a machine shop to get it done. And let the tire on it, wheel and tire. Leave the drum bolted up to the wheel. And then all you got to do is skin the inside. I think from first contact, I took about 30 thousandths per side, total of 60, and it trued that up. Then take your back plates, after you get it all cut and everything, and the drums turned, take your back plates to your local brake shop and tell them to put some uncured brake linings on there. They were softer. And tell them to arc them and true them up with that drum. And they'll sand them in, make them fit that drum. And first time I put them on last weekend, I took off and I just about dumped it on its nose. I couldn't believe it. It got plenty of brakes. I can hold full throttle on a static.
Let me make one comment. I want to make one comment on this, that somebody called me up and told me he tried this on his brakes. They were really chattery and didn't work too good, so what he did was he ran down a 7,000-foot runway, holding the brakes, tail up, just putting enough brake pressure on to get a really hot. He says that darn thing bent right out and conformed to it, and he says after that his brakes worked perfect. So I tried that on this KR1. I ran down Chino, holding brakes pressure on to get them really hot. Not enough to melt the tires, by the way, but evidently the drum itself got red hot, and I'll be darned if it didn't conform, and I haven't had a bit of chatter since. It's working great. Go ahead.
Forget what I said, that sounds a whole lot easier. I think it's off success. I was carrying 14. Okay, the question was, how much weight did I have when I took the camping trip with a friend of mine? If you add it up real quick, I weigh 140 pounds. He weighed, giving a reasonable benefit of doubt, say he weighed 220. And I 14 gallons of fuel, which is full. Probably 20 pounds of baggage. Somebody can come up with that real quick. You're ahead of me. I'm not even going to try. 500? Okay, there's 500 pounds. My empty weight on my airplane is 5 and a quarter. So there's over 1,000 pounds. I didn't know I'd have that much in it. Feeling pretty good, too. I'll tell you, let me make a point real quick on the weight. It doesn't really make any difference on your cruise speed. Maybe a couple of miles an hour. Ken, isn't that about right? I've had people say, let me get out and you can really make a fast, hot pass. Well, it doesn't matter because with two people in there, one person cruise does not make that much difference. Climb is the big difference. I get, by myself, I climb at about 1,800 to 1,900 feet a minute, and with somebody in there, 180, 90 pounds, it's more like 1,300 feet a minute. So I lose about 500 feet on the climb. Still a flag on that.
Where'd I put the baggage? Where'd I put the baggage? I made a little area behind the, right behind the seat, and you'll look at it. Mine's the blue one out there, 4DD. There's an area about that deep, coming a little shelf back behind the little rail behind your seat, and it goes up inside the turtle deck. It's just a Naga hide sewed up deal. In that condition, I take off with full nose down trim. And that's real slow at 10. You have to hold forward stick even still. Although in cruise, you still bring her back up. In cruise, you don't need all that trim. By myself, I tend to put almost full nose up trim when I'm by myself because I'm just kind of a weenie. What kind of modification on the firewall? Just like the plans show. When I built that plane, I didn't know anything, and I was afraid to deviate from the plans one word. So it's about as plans built as you can go, except for the canopy. I've made it a little higher to get over my head. Yeah.
on the canopy. How did I build that? Well, the plans are all drawn up for it in the newsletter a couple of months back. You might subscribe to that if the fellows that don't have it, a lot of you will recall it. The canopy, those are the panels are made for an Emerod from Boeing's Aerospace. They advertise in the back of Sport Aviation. They're $75 a pair. The windshield, you got to make yourself. How did I do it? Boy, we could get into some drawings, I guess. It's got a wood frame around the door with foam to make the curves, and then it's just the epoxied into place with one layer of cloth. Does that help? Okay.
You're asking about the airfoil we're using. We're using the REF 48. And what about the stall characteristics you want to know? Oh, that's the GEW-1. We're not using that on this airplane. He asked about the airfoil as well. Stall characteristics on this airfoil is as gentle as can be. No power or low power, it just falls, you get a small shutter just above the stall and it falls through. Mine never drops a wing then. At real high power settings and is when it might start getting a little drastic. I tried it one day at 50 inches manifold pressure, and my KR2 snapped on its back and went into a spin right away. It was kind of shocking. I did a full turn before I even realized what was happening. But it comes right out of the spin. There was no problem there. Also, there's another thing about stalls. I've tried stalling it in above a 60-degree bank, and it gets kind of wild then, and it can flip over that and go right into a spin then, too. Yes?
Which of the NACA airfoil sections is the RF-48 most comparable to?
Which American airfoil is that most comparable to? I haven't the foggiest idea. I really don't. When we were looking at airfoils, but when I was first playing with this, when I was at Douglas Aircraft, we were going through everything and what we were trying to do is find something that a student pilot could fly and still be a fighter plane airfoil. And that particular one is the one we came up with, that's all. And actually, we've never regretted it. I'm not about to change it now. Not after all the experience I've gotten since then, I found I sort of lucked onto this. Yes? What other engines have we heard about on the KR-1s and 2s? I have heard of several Corvairs, but I haven't heard of any of them flying. I've even had pictures sent to me showing on really cherry KR-2s with a Corvair engine out in front there running merrily away, but I haven't heard a thing about performance or anything like that. Motorcycle engines. What about motorcycle engines? I have never heard of any installations yet, and I'm not about to do any experiment in that because vibration and everything like that, so I figure it'd be about a year's development time, and I don't want to get into that. He asked about the plans. This is a KR2? Well, they haven't actually changed. We just added more information, just mostly from the letters and so on like that on the later plans. We've just added maybe a few more drawings just to make it clearer on some points that we've had a lot of questions on. The plans actually haven't changed. Yes, I guess you could. Send into the shop, let's see, it's about $10 printing charge. Why don't you just do that? Send that in, say you want a new set of plans in. We'll send to. Make sure you put your serial number or the date you bought it so it can be checked. Okay. He asked about the control travel, and he wanted to know if the later plans actually specify limits. I don't really remember if I added in or not, but I'll tell you what they are right now. Aileron travel is looking at the inboard tip. it should be up about, you should be able to have get 1 inch up travel and half an inch down travel. And on the rudder is plus or minus 30 degrees. Elevator, you need 30 degrees up and 20 degrees down. If you have these limits or more, you're going to be fine. He asked the status on the motor glider. Well, like I was just saying a little while ago, it's been finished, it's licensed. We hadn't put the final coat of paint on it, but the guys in the shop said it'd be done by the time I got back from Oshkosh. But it's been parked there for about a year with not much done on it. It's running. We run the engine every so often. It's a KR-1 with just a long set of wings. So it's a single-place airplane. He asked if it was two-place or one-place. Yes? Do I have any comments between 1/8 and 3/32 cables? Okay, I do have comments on it. I know on factory-certified airplanes, the requirement by law is 1/8 cable. But putting 1/8 cable in this small, lighter airplane and the turns you have to make and so on like that, it makes the controls a lot stiffer. So at 3/32 cables, it's still way overboard of what we need, what the requirements are. You're only talking about ounces of pull on these cables. So I prefer the 3/32 cable. 1/16 cable would be adequate, except that it doesn't look good, and it makes the FAA nervous. So we compromise with 3/32, and I know some FAA inspectors have given a few people some static on this, but it's so much smoother on the controls than using 1/8 cable. That's why we specify it. And on a non-certified airplane, the law says you can use anything you like. So that's the reason why we can get away with it. Yes? Yes, he asked about the travel on the ailerons. That is at the tip, right. That's right, the trailing edge tip, right. You look for this amount of travel. If you have that, you have absolutely adequate travel. On a KR-1 with that much travel, I guess the roll rate's about the same as a Pitts. Yes? He wants to know what size Posa carburetor you use. He has a 36-horse VW. The 36-horse actually will take either a 26 or 29-millimeter. I think the 26 is the better one, better choice. Anything bigger than 1600, well, actually 17 and 1834 takes a 29-millimeter, definitely. And 2100s and bigger is a 32-millimeter. And the turbo 2100s, it takes 32-millimeter. We sell you whatever you ask for. Well, actually, those are the only three sizes we carry. See, I know people have ordered 35 millimeters, and we've gotten them for special orders, putting them on Lycomings and Continentals. See, but we don't actually stock the 35 millimeter. Yes? Do I have a longer wing for the KR-2? No, for a big reason. If we started making an inno-motor glider, it's a single-place thing, and we're liable to hear about somebody flying with two people doing that and hit some big thermal gusts, and we didn't run any stress analysis doing this. And so if you're going to do any experiments like that, you're going to do it without our drawings. Have I tried winglets on the KR-2? I have talked to the NASA people on that. And they believe, like I kind of figured, that if on this airplane, in this airfoil and all this, we wouldn't be able to notice any difference. So why go through the hassle?
Besides, you don't want to make it look like a very easy.
There you go. So he doesn't want it to look like a very easy. Yeah. Now, if we were pushing Mach 0.5 or better, yeah, it probably would. Because then you could go to a smaller, much smaller wing, and you're looking for maximum efficiency way up there. But under 200 miles an hour, I don't think you could possibly notice any difference. Yes. Yes. He wants to know if it... Okay, he wants to know if he can lengthen the fuselage. He says it looks too short for him. He wants to lengthen it just for looks. Well, lengthening it, you'd have to also lengthen the nose, too, because you'd get it out of balance. Even with that, what do you got, 65 Continental? Oh, Lycoming. Oh, okay. 170-pound engine. Okay, it sounds like it would work then. Yeah, yes. Keep the engine, yeah. Oh, I would never go 8 inches, no. I was thinking you're up to about 3 or 4 inches. I wouldn't go more than that. Then you'd have to move the engine to even further forward than that. See, so a couple inches won't hurt anything. Yeah. Oh. 12 inches is 4 inches longer? I didn't know that. Well, that, people have lots of reasons for making changes to the plans, but so that KR1 with a 36 horse is not flown mainly because the owner of it is working on his private pilot's license. I haven't heard if he soloed yet or not. He has not soloed a Cub. I happen to know that. There was somebody else in the airplane with him. He might have flown it by himself, but... Okay. Okay. So, yes. Well, if he wants my opinion of removing the fuel tank from the nose and only using the wing tanks. Well, for one thing, you'd have a big development problem trying to how to get the fuel to the gas to the engine, because suppose the carburetors only work with gravity feed, so you're still going to have some kind of either a float system or some holding tank up there. So that's another development problem. I just don't have the time to look into. I actually have no use for tip tanks when you got so much room in the wings for fuel. I don't see any reason for adding extra drag when you don't need it. The KR2 wings can hold up to 30 gallons each. Yes, there was a... I can't hear that. I can't hear you. What about CG problems, taking the fuel out of the nose and putting it all in the wings? The fuel in the wings isn't that far after the max FCG. So it doesn't really affect it that much. It's still a matter of working out the weight and balance when you finish the airplane. It'd be up to the individual airplane. Yes, right here. How much fuel do I carry in my main tank? Well, for one thing, my front tank was made before the pre-molded parts came out. So mine only holds 10 gallons, especially now that I've cut out so much of it to put in all the extra radios. My KR2 is full IFR. So every time I added another radio, I'm going to cut another big hunk out of it. Glue a block of foam in it that had epoxied and everything else, and then carving that out again. So it's pretty well got a funny front rear end of it. So it holds 10 gallons. Now, the pre-molded ones we're selling now that we make in the shop, and I'm going to put one in my airplane as soon as I get a chance. It holds 17 gallons. It's much deeper, and it conforms around a radio rack and everything else. So... And I'll tell you, on this trip, I wished I had that tank in there because my fuel transfer pump went out coming in here. It's been working all right for the last 4 years. And that's a regular aircraft Bendix fuel pump, too, and that darn thing failed on me. You know, it's the factory, it's the airplane parts that you got to worry about around here. So anyway, I only had my 10-gallon forward tank for the last halfway here. That meant 2 hours range, and I like an hour reserve when I'm in strange territory. That meant quite a bit of a hitch hopping. So I hit so many new airports in the last few days that actually more than I did in the last about 3 years. So I was stopping every hour and 15 minutes all along the way here. Yes? The pre-molded tank's only for the two. We don't have one for the one. We can make them up. We made up the tooling because when we rebuilt this one, we used a molded tank. But we just haven't run any off because I don't know of any demand for them yet. Largest fuel capacity for a front tank on a KR1, I think this one holds 11 gallons. Yes, on the front tank, but my wing tanks also hold 20 apiece, so it gives me... Oh, you only want the fuselage tank. It could be made to hold 12 gallons if you did it carefully enough and you measured how high up your toes were and you put up the bottom of the gas tank right down to them. I think it'll hold 12 or 13 gallons. It could be done. Yes. Well,
pre-blow your tank, it's pretty well, you'd have to cut the top off if you already done that to put it in. But so you could put any top on it, even though one comes with it. It comes with part of the instrument panel, too, that you can cut out to fit your individual airplane. Yes, the glass is flexible enough, and it can be bent around. And of course, one thing about fiberglass is if any place that doesn't fit or anything like that, you just grind it away or re-glass some more on it. See, they're so easily modified. And as far as pre-molded culls are concerned, when I put the Turbo 2100 on here and the lift constant speed prop, that moved my prop forward a few inches and changed my whole front end a little bit. And so my old cowl that I'd made per the plans sure didn't fit anymore. And so rather than start from scratch, I just took one of the pre-molded ones out of the bin and set it up there, ground away any place it didn't clear, and then started glassing on additions where I needed to fill it in. And it turned out I did the whole thing in a day, where if I had to start from scratch, it would have been a week's job. Yes. What is the KR2 stress for? Well, it was originally run at 800 pounds, and it came out around 7, plus or minus 7 Gs. We haven't done that much more. Since then, several people run sandbag checks and checked it up to 7 Gs at 900 pounds. See, so. The highest we've ever pulled in flight recorded was 5.5. In the original test flights, we had a recording G meter in it, and a test pilot did pull 5.5 Gs on one test. He wants to know if he should get the culling before he puts it on his front deck. Actually, it doesn't really matter because you'll probably do so much modifying anyway to fit your individual engine installation that it can be cut and added or sliced and widened if you need to. Some people had to cut and narrow it. So it's my opinion is there's no problem. And of course, it does match up the pre-molded gas tank and forward deck anyway. So it doesn't matter what order you do it in. Yes, question over here. Where's the status of the KR3? Well, as I said, we're putting it back together, and it looks like it might be. We might finish it by the end of the year, and have it flying again. Well, we have the 4412 on there now, the airfoil. Yes. Pardon? Oh, I see. Okay. Yes, back there. Have I heard of anybody using a Hunt engine in this airplane? I know of people who have built up the engines, but I don't know if anybody's tried one in a KR1 or KR2 yet. I'm trying to think of a real interesting engine installation that was different. I forgot what they call it. What do they call that four-cylinder inline airplane engine that was made in World War II in Europe? The Micron, Walter Micron. Right, there's a KR1 flying in New Zealand with a Walter Micron, and it looks just like a little tiny P-40. Okay, over here. The pre-molded parts are polyester resin and epoxy and fiberglass. Yes. Is it possible to cabin heating? Did you say? Yes, I know one in Pennsylvania. The builder put on a KR2 put heat muffs on his exhaust pipes and piped the air in, and he said it worked great all last winter. And by the way, I heard that airplane got banged up just recently. That's why it's not here. Put in the trees. Yeah, they said Paul Dieter. Yeah, they said his canopy came off in flight, and he landed at the next airport. He got it down all right, and this was 60 miles from Rome, so he went over the airplane and figured, well, he got it down here all right. Why not? So he decided to fly it home that way, and took off, but it took full power to go 80 miles an hour. See, nobody had been cruising at 50%, about 150 miles an hour. Anyway, he noticed his temperatures were running way too high, and he just kept it at it. He had to run firewall just to keep it flying. And evidently, the temperatures just went right out of sight, and the engine seized, and he put it in the trees. No, he didn't get hurt at all. But he dinged the airplane pretty bad, from what I heard. Yes. How much tail service do we have in the KR1? Well, that was the reason why we picked the KR1 to go do this mod, because we would not have to change any tail surfaces. How about control movement, did you say? It's not changed. It was the same. It's identical to this airplane here, the tail. No response to this pitch. I have no foggiest idea. We've never flown it. It's still parked in my hangar. I may get a chance to fly as soon as I get back from Oshkosh. Yes, question over here. He's asking why we originally was using an 8-to-1 and now we're using a 1-to-1 epoxy. Well, for one thing, the 1-to-1 epoxy is so much easier to mix and so much easier to keep it uniform. The 8-to-1 was so critical that we noticed quite a few, half our batches we had to test first, and some of them didn't set up and some set up too fast. And so the 1-to-1 we've had much better luck with. And as far as putting some epoxy on the foam first, we do that whenever we want it to stick up there good. But you can just lay the cloth on first, and the epoxy will soak right through either way. But sometimes when you have to, it's a vertical surface or something like that, it's easier to put a paint some on first and stick it on there, and that way it doesn't fall off while you're pouring your epoxy on. That's the main thing. Yes. How low a temperature will this 1-to-1 mix work? The lowest we've been using it for it is about 50 degrees, but it got down to 40 during over the night, and we found out the next day that it's still pretty, like rubber the next day. So anytime we do it when it's that cold, we just let it set for a couple days before we have to do any sanding or anything like that. It still sets up. It just takes a couple of days before it gets real hard. Yes? Yes. The question was, he's enjoyed the Care2 newsletter and would like to know if Butch Coppy would say anything on it. Would you want to say something on it, Butch? He's right here.
I'd rather have Dan Deal up here talking. He's better talking than I am. I like to listen to him talk. No, I enjoy putting out the newsletter. I enjoy hearing from all you guys, and I hope you're getting something out of the newsletter. It's a lot more work than what I first intended. I'm going to continue with it as long as I possibly can. I have no intentions of stopping it or make it any smaller. I hope to make it as big as possible as we go. Yeah, there's definitely, as you can see yourself, there's more and more people interested in this KR every day. As long as people keep sending in their ideas, I'll keep putting them in the newsletter and getting them out to you. Any problems or modifications that come along, I get them in. As more new guys come along, some of the questions tend to repeat themselves, but they're new guys, and so the guys have been milling a while. You're going to have to bear with the questions to get the information going. There's KR Club now. I wasn't really going to get started on that myself, but more and more people wanted it, and somebody had to do it. So I put it in the newsletter, and the response has been fantastic. When I left home, you know, they're coming in, well, 3 and 4 a day, every day for the last 30 days, and I expect when I get home, I'll have a stack of mail yay high on this, and then I'm going to get sorting them out and sending out the membership cards and addresses to the other members. Is there any questions I can help you with? Yes, sir. Yeah, I do keep back issues available all the time. Right now there's 37 issues out and 38 issues, and I'll be glad to send back issues out. The address is 6141 Choctaw Drive, Westminster, California. Zip code is 92683. Zip code is 92683. Yes. All right. I just got in last night, and I put some out. Ken's got one in his pocket here. I'm on A Street, south side of A Street, just a quarter of the way up from the flight line side. And anybody in here is welcome to come by anytime. I'm going to stock up on some iced tea, maybe some beer, and so you're welcome to come by. Yes, sir. I sold my KR2 mostly to use the money to start my KR1. So it's just what I'm in love with, you know. A fellow by name Steve Cox bought it. He was a glider pilot. He wanted to get his power rating, and he said it looked like the cheapest way to go. Well, he wasn't happy with the 1700 I had, and he wanted more power, and so he put a new engine in it, which he had problems with, and an engine out deal. The airplane has been destroyed. Him and the flight instructor with him were injured slightly. I guess they're both recuperated now, but the airplane just no more. Yes, sir. The one, right. From what I hear, the airplane was flying so well, he got to showing off a little bit. He's doing short field takeoffs, just tried to take it off too short. It went in on takeoff. No engine power, no nothing. He just pulled it back too soon, way at airspeed. Any other questions? All right, now, like I said, you guys are welcome to come by the campsite anytime. I want to talk to each and every one of you if I can. It's going to be a lot of talking. Thank you much.
Yeah, okay. You know, let me get a couple more questions here then. The original KR1s, no, they would not be, because we completely redid the KR1 plans since then, especially after the KR2 came out. Why don't you get with me after out of this, and we'll fix you up. Yes? Are you still using the same epoxy? We're using, the epoxy we use is a half and half mix shell, 8-pon 815, and General Mills Versamid 125. For all of them we tried, this has given us the best service and everything else and easiest to work with. I know on the Varies these are using a Shell 8-pon 828, and I've looked into getting it, and it's $8 a barrel cheaper. So, but as long as you make an 815, I'm going to continue using it because it's better. I'm positive it's better. We're using the same epoxy, yes. Right, definitely. Yeah, that's he is talking about Will Newbert's article in Sport Aviation. Actually, he thought the 828 had a better temperature range. According to the engineering analysis, it was the other way around. And I don't remember the article offhand, but I thought that was the same way. The data sheet shows the other way around, that the 815 has better temperature range. And according to Shell, it's also the same way. Shell 8.815 is what we use in our kits. Well, for the B part, you mean? Yeah, the B part is General Mills Versamid 125. Yes. Just how critical are these epoxies? Actually, not very. Not very at all. Okay. Well, I don't know what that particular kind is, but in my opinion, it's probably okay. Yes. What about using the epoxy on the wood structure? That's what we advocate. No, none whatsoever. I mean, matter of fact, I think that's the best combination, especially people that aren't too used to woodworking. If you use going to these other glues, you have to have really good glue joints. And with the epoxy, it's not nearly as critical. It's not as nearly as temperature critical either. So we tell them to use the same epoxy for everything. Unless, of course, you want to just glue up a tab or something, you want it hard right now, then you can go the 5-minute kind. Yes. Can you still get dry rot on the wood? Yes, you can, but not under the epoxy. It'll be somewhere else. Well, I really don't know. He's asking about dry rot on the wood. I really don't know that much about woods. I'm not the one to ask on that. I varnished all the wood on mine before closing everything up. That's about all I could do. Yes. Yeah, is there any thinners you can use with epoxy? Use it in place of varnish. I know there's a thinner available, but I would rather not use it because I don't know what it does structurally to the epoxy. And as far as just using it for varnish, why not just use varnish in that case? That's what I did. So I think it's our time's about up, isn't it? Anybody know? Yes, I'll give it to Omar. Oh, he says there is an epoxy varnish available. In a boat store? Okay, that answers your question. See, I didn't have that answer. Yep. Okay, well, anyway, my KR1 I've got right here. You can see it. And if anybody wants any plans, they are available here at the fly-in for both airplanes. And that's about it. Anything else? Right, we'll get one more here. Am I going to run the KR1 in the efficiency contest? I really don't know if I have time. If I do, I probably will. It's in flying condition and everything else, and it's just a matter of my getting to it. I'm going to enter the efficiency contest with the KR2. The KR2 actually has a better chance of winning it because I can fly it so much slower, especially with those new flaps. So, okay, that's it.